Friends, Romans, countrymen, you might want to sit down. This could take a while. Today's dispatch of Caesar's Gallic War is quite substantive, but then again, Caesar always was impressive with his eloquence. Before we commence, I'd like to acknowledge the kind patronage of Magister McGinn from the shores of the Atlantic Ocean in coastal North Carolina. He dedicates this to his outstanding students and their love of Caesar. Ave Caesar. A fine offering indeed, and we all love Caesar. Now, as you may recall, the delightful Caesar, who doesn't have to go changing to try and please me, he's never let me down before, has dealt soundly with the Belgae. Unfortunately, the ungrateful Nervii were now causing troubles. These are the words of Caesar as conveyed by Rhiannon Evans and Matt Smith. Upon this information, Caesar sent forward scouts and centurions to choose a fit place for camp. Now, a considerable number of the surrendered Belgae and of the other Gauls were in the train of Caesar
and marched with him, and certain of these, as was afterwards learnt from prisoners, having remarked the usual order of our army's march during those days, came by night to the Nervii. Okay. And showed to them that between legion and legion a great quantity of baggage was interposed, and that it was an easy matter when the first legion had reached camp and the rest were a great space away to attack it while it was in heavy marching order. Bit devious, really, that.
Well, they've spotted a flaw.
Yeah, they have. And they're betraying Caesar, who was benevolent to them. But anyway, for those who came in late, Rhiannon, who are the Nervii?
The Nervii are Belgic peoples. If you remember, in our previous episode, Caesar had defeated the Belloaci and the Suessiones. They were Belgic, but they were very near to the border of what we're calling Celtica, the central part of Gaul. Whereas the Nervii are a bit further in, and they've been described as really tough.
Yeah. Right?
They don't do trade with people.
That's right. They don't like wine.
Yeah, that's too soft for them.
Yeah.
Because of these kind of cultural differences and their location, they're much closer in terms of their society and their toughness to the Germani. So he's got this whole sort of spectrum of Gauls, that they get tougher the closer they get to the Germani, as we've seen. And the Nervii are a good example of this. And I've always wondered, by the way, the name Nervii is very close to the Latin term that means muscle or strength.
Nice.
I wonder if some of that is resounding too.
Yeah, look, probably, but I was wondering what the connection is to Nerva, the Roman emperor. Was he from that region at all?
Ooh, I don't think that's been theorized. No, he's from an old Italian family.
Yeah, so. Italian families have to come from somewhere.
Well, I guess they do indeed.
In the previous battles, a number of Belgae had been absorbed into the Roman army by the sounds of it, but members of this have now left and told the Nervii about the formation of Julius Caesar's army.
Well, they've been conquered by the Romans, so they're being taken along with them. And some of them do escape, and they basically become spies, I suppose. They're giving information
and why wouldn't you?
Intel to the Nervii.
You warn the people down the track.
Yeah, and give them information about where the weak points are for the Romans so that the Nervii can, if they want to, make use of that.
Yes, and in this case, it's baggage.
Yeah, so the
which is more exciting than it sounds. But it's all the...
Let's hope so, because it's going to dominate this review.
But it's
chapters.
All the army's gear, really, you know, the tents, the food, the spare weapons.
Certain amount they carry themselves, each of the soldiers. But yeah, there's a whole lot of supplies, and we've seen how important supplies are for Caesar.
Yeah.
The Nervii will then form a plan to attack that because it's kind of in a vulnerable position between the legions. So it's not fully protected as the army marches along in line. And there's two ways of marching that baggage. If you imagine it like a train, it's like a carriage on its own, I suppose. Mm. Or you can package the legion around it in a way and put it in the middle. And you tend to do that if you're in hostile territory.
Okay, so you don't get attacked from the flanks.
Yeah. The supplies, in a way, are more important than the soldiers in this case. Or at least the soldiers can defend themselves more easily.
Yeah. Look, I can see the reasoning of that. The interesting thing is that Caesar has this information and he says that it's conveyed to him later by prisoners that, you know, this is the situation, this is the setup.
Caesar seems to know everything at this point, though, as we'll see. He doesn't tell us until quite late in the day that he's been able to foil their plan. So while he's building up to the story, I've already put the spoiler in there, but while he's building it up, you can see there might be a bit of tension for the reader, that they think, oh, this really is a vulnerability of the Romans. And for the Roman reader, that would be sort of terrifying that these tough nervy might exploit that vulnerability, might be able to take out this really important part of the Roman war effort. So there's a few chapters where you're not sure what's going to be the outcome.
And now we get a little bit of information about the Nervii and how they organise themselves with their forces.
A bit like the way that they aren't into culture and wine, they also draw up their army in a different way, and they don't have very much cavalry at all. They regard it as something that hampers them. And I think, although Caesar doesn't state it outright, there's a kind of, they stick to the simple way of fighting. They've got the infantry. Yeah. You just get in there and it's much more direct.
Yeah, no point leaving anybody in reserve. Just everyone gather up and rush in.
The implication is that they don't have this variety. They don't have the kind of foresight or the long-term plan that the Romans have. However, they're presented as doing what they have with their minimal resources. It's sort of simple, but potentially effective. What we're told they do is they bend saplings and weave them into a wall-like hedge. So it's sort of raffia, I suppose.
Yeah.
In order to hamper the progress in view of the enemy. It's camouflage, basically, isn't it? They're going to hide behind this, and it also protects them to a certain extent. It's not very sophisticated. It's not metal or even chopped wood. I don't mean to downplay that as much as I'm sounding.
No,
there,
but it is but as effective Caesar's as terms, it needs to be. Yeah. It's effective, but it's not going to last. But
yeah.
They don't need it to at the same time.
It's pretty ephemeral.
Yeah. So the Romans established camp. We're told that they camped in a valley near the river Sabus. And we're also told that the Nervii are hiding in the woods and can't be seen.
Yeah, we get a description of this in chapter 18, where the whole chapter is really just Caesar setting up the scene. I think of it as like an establishing shot in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on opposite sides of the river, and the hill rises gently on either side. So the Romans are on one side, the Nervii trees start halfway up the hill, and the Nervii are sort of camouflaging themselves there amongst the trees.
Yes. While we know this detail now, at the time, the Romans completely oblivious. We're setting up a camp. We're going to attack the Nervii. They'll never see us coming. Baggage train is fine.
And Caesar has sent on his cavalry, and he's coming up with his forces.
It isn't exactly how the Nervii expect it to be travelling, is it?
No, he specifically says the arrangement and order of the column was different from the report given by the Belgae to the Nervii. And Caesar has reacted as if, as he says, as if approaching an enemy, as he was approaching an enemy. He moved 6 legions in light field order, after them placed the baggage of the whole army, then 2 legions which had been last brought up the rear of the whole column and formed the baggage guard. So he's got a guard on them. He's put the baggage in the middle in a more defensive position.
Yes.
Not just baggage after each legion.
Which is what you would do if you're travelling through hostile territory.
Yeah, so he's got some sixth sense, apparently, because he hasn't told us of information at this point, that he needs to go into this defensive mode, that he knows that there is a problem ahead. So this isn't what the Nervii are expecting to encounter. So this is going to be trouble for them. What we might note throughout this section of the narrative is the number of chapters where the word Caesar appears right at the beginning, certainly in Latin, if not in the often in the translation too. He's right at the beginning of that chapter, chapter 19, and he's right at the beginning of the next chapter as well, where things get really quite exciting.
Yes.
As exciting as things can get over baggage, I think. Sorry, are we at that point or have I got ahead of myself?
You've got a little bit of ahead of yourself. We now have the cavalry being engaged, so the Nervii decide to press what they believe is the advantage and attack in what I find to be a very sudden, opportunistic way. There seems to be very little planning on their behalf, but you know.
The Gauls are often presented in this way, the Gauls as a whole. You could generalize this to northern barbarians. There are very few occasions where they're seen to have real strategy, and it's more tactics than strategy. The mm-hmm. immediate might be there, but the more medium term or long term just isn't part of their thought process, which is probably grossly unfair, but yes. It's the way Caesar presents them.
The cavalry who were setting up the camp see the enemy and they cross the river to engage them, not waiting for Caesar's command. They're taking the initiative here.
Yeah, there's a few parts in this battle where Caesar seems to commend his own, because there isn't time, because he doesn't seem to have all of the foreknowledge. He's glad that his troops are experienced and can just react to events very quickly and in a defensive manner.
Mm.
But the Nervii just see the baggage section and they rush out of the woods. They're beaten quite quickly. Then they hurry uphill towards the Roman camp. So that's kind of a crisis that the enemy is now making for camp.
And it's an unfinished camp, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. They haven't had a chance to complete it here. And Caesar just talks about how fast they are. Everything's happening really fast.
I got that impression from this whole chapter. There's a lot of words and terms that convey that.
Yeah, the main word that comes up quite a few times is celeritas, which literally means speed, celerity. With incredible speed, the enemy rushed down to the river so that almost at the same moment, it's like it's all been conflated together, they were seen at the edge of the woods, in the river, and then in close quarters. So again, I think it's quite cinematic. You imagine this being edited in that very quick way that you can't quite tell what's going on.
I hate that guy.
And then they're doing battle scenes, I know. But you can tell with Caesar because he's very clear, but he's saying it's happening before you have a chance to take it in. You feel like a participant in it almost, the way he narrates this.
Yeah.
Then with the same speed again, they hastened uphill against our camp and the troops engaged in entrenching it. So they're still doing the entrenching and the enemy is upon them.
20, as you said, again with Caesar.
Yeah, so again, chapter 20 begins with Caesar. Mm. And it's, I think, quite a rare point that sees him under stress, under pressure. But he has, and this is one of his typical phrases, he had everything to do at once. All right. I think there's more pressure here than often when he uses this phrase. Usually it's, you know, he's got to sort out the corn supply and he's got to think about where they're going to camp. But here it's real pressure. It's got to all happen at once. Otherwise they're doomed, basically. And he gives this kind of to-do list.
Yeah, he kind of explains how stressful it is, I think.
Yeah, I don't know whether people are interested in the grammar, but he's using a form called the gerundive, which we don't have in English grammar. And it's one word which means this was to be done. It had to be done. Mm. So there's this compulsion every time he mentions a verb, every time he mentions an action. This was to be done by Caesar. All the things that were to be done by him, some of which, by the way, I know he didn't personally do.
Come on, I want the Latin here.
Okay.
Yeah, just read it. I want the Werungians.
Oh, I wish they were called that. Caesari omnia uno tempore erant agenda. So agenda is from the verb ago. That means I do, I drive.
What's he doing?
That's everything was to be done at once.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Vexillum proponendum. All right, so that's the flag to be raised.
Yes.
And then I'm just going to skip over a subclause here. Signum tubar dandum. The signal was to be given on the trumpet.
Yes.
As I say, I can't see Caesar doing either of these things personally.
No, but it has to happen all at once.
It has to happen. Ab opere revocandi milites. The soldiers to be called back from their work, from doing the trenches.
So
for
it's
the
muster up.
Yeah. He might have done that, I guess.
Yeah. And oi, you miserable lot, get in line.
It's a very Monty Python version. And then a whole list of them. So
I've got et cetera here. Is that in the translation?
Yeah, it's Latin, et cetera, and the other things.
Yeah.
The ones who'd gone a bit further away, qui paulo longius agoris petendi, to be sought. For the acies instruenda, which means the battle line to be drawn up.
But meanwhile, the Nervii are coming on horseback.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you've still got stuff to do. Milites cohortandi, which means the soldiers to be encouraged. Signum dandum, which I thought we'd already done, but that's the signal to be given. It's obviously a new signal.
New signal.
Then he says, a great part of these duties was prevented by the shortness of time and the advance of the enemy. So as you say, the Nervii are coming on and he's got all this stuff to do.
No wonder he literally says he's under stress.
Yeah, he does. He uses this word difficultates.
You don't need to translate that. That's fine.
These difficulties. in our translations, the stress of the moment. This is one of those kind of famous points, the point at which Caesar kind of congratulates his troops. Mm-hmm. The ordinary troops are people he can rely on. He says there are two things that mean it's okay. The stress is relieved by these. And the foremost one is his troops are experienced. They've got scientia, knowledge.
Okay.
And what he means here is they've been through book one with him, right? They've been through, and then the beginning of book two, for that matter. They know what to do because they've already been engaged in battle with him and against these Gauls.
Yes.
Yeah. He doesn't have to give them every single little instruction.
Gandalf says the same thing in book two of Lord of the Rings. He says, right. Yeah, you fellowship are fine. We all went through book one together. That's how he opened it up.
Well, good to know he's based on Caesar. So one of the things he's implying here is that they're very resourceful themselves, that they don't need to be micromanaged in effect. He also says that he's got legati, his sub-generals, his sub-lieutenants.
His lieutenant generals in the translation, yeah.
He knows that they will finish the entrenching.
Mm. We'll take care of the Nervii on horseback coming across the river. So now he turns and he addresses the 10th Legion. And I am astounded that his full speech isn't in here. Men, Roman, countrymen kind of thing. He gives a few, you know, I talked about this. I imbued them with this.
Part of it, of course, is that if he'd done that, it would be quite literary.
Yes.
But it would also be quite unrealistic because he's given us two chapters of time was of the essence. So if he gives a two-page speech at this point...
Plutarch would have done it.
It's true. It might happen in a lot of history. It would certainly be a very epic thing to do, I think. But Caesar actually makes a point of that. And he starts the chapter again, Caesar, first word. Mm-hmm. He gave the commands that he needed to. And then he harangues the troops and he came to the 10th Legion. But he specifically says his harangue to the troops was no more than a charge to bear in mind their ancient valor, to be free from alarm and to bravely withstand the onslaught of the enemy. But you see, that in itself is quite rhetorical and literary in that having three things is what we call a tricolon.
Yeah.
Where giving posh words to these things in literature. And it kind of builds up. It can be quite a rousing speech to do this. You do this and you do this and you do this and now go off and do it in this particular circumstance. And I like the list because, of course, it makes them think of the past, their ancient valor, that they're Romans and they've got to be proud of that and all the things Rome's done.
Yes.
That they shouldn't be scared right now. And in the future, they should bravely withstand, because he's kind of going through the tenses here, the past, the present, the future.
Go and
withstand the enemy.
So with the 10th Legion properly enthused now to engage the enemy, Caesar goes, right, job well done. I'm going to go and tell the other guys. And then he turns around and goes, oh, I can feel there's like a drop there in what he's saying, because they're already fighting.
Yeah. I mean, he's already said the enemy are no further off than the range of a missile, which is kind of crisis point, because if they can throw something at you, then that means it's time to stop fighting, isn't it?
Mm.
And he says quite unnecessarily, I think, the time was so short. You really do feel like you're in amongst them here. I know we're going through these chapters in gruesome detail, but I think there is a reason for that, that they're artfully constructed.
Mm.
He says there's no time to put their, what in the translation is their badges in place, which is their insignia, probably on their helmets. And there's no time even to put on helmets, he says, and to draw the covers from their shields.
Yeah.
Their shields are wooden, bound together with leather, and then they've got leather covers on them.
So you take them out of the leather cover.
But there's no time.
No time. They're
still in the leather covers.
Okay.
In whichever direction each man chanced to come in from entrenching, whatever standard each first caught sight of, by that he stood to lose no fighting time in seeking out his proper company. So they can't go and find their specific cohort.
Yes.
You know, the people they're meant to be fighting beside, they just have to fight where they are.
Yeah. Gather under any standard you see and off you go.
Yeah, I mean, they're disorganized, but then luckily the Gauls are quite disorganized too.
Yeah, but they're that quick on it that they've got the element of surprise.
They do.
So chapter 23, in which we actually get military descriptions, which I was shocked by because Caesar hasn't been big on that up to this point.
often military historians are very impatient with ancient writers for not giving us enough of this.
I guess it shows you as well how much of the thick of it Caesar was in at this time.
He clearly is there. He isn't just on a hill directing the fight. He's in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
He's keen to show us that. And I don't think there's much reason to doubt it. I mean, it's one of the reasons, presumably, his troops were so loyal.
So he starts off with the 9th and 10th legions, 10th legion, who he's just given a rousing speech to, who had formed up on the left flank, discharged their pikes, and as they possessed the higher ground, speedily drove towards the Atrebates, which is the section which happened to face them, an ally of the Nervii.
Yeah, exactly.
At the time, driven into the river, breathless as they were with running and weakened from wounds, and pursuing them with the sword as they endeavoured to cross, they slew a great part of them while in difficulties. Off go the 9th and 10th legion. In the meantime, 11th and 8th legion, having broken the Viramandui, with whom they had engaged, left the higher ground and continued the fight on the very banks of the river.
Yeah, the river plays a big part in this battle. They're either slaughtering troops in the river.
Yes.
Or they're kind of backing them up against the river in order to get them into difficulties. So it turns out to be not such a great place to engage the Romans because they're making the most of the landscape.
And in the meantime, the camp is unguarded.
Yes, this is a problem. The Nervii, led by another great named Gaul, Boduognatus.
I would not have picked that for the pronunciation, but okay.
The end of his name looks much more Roman than Gallic, but there you go.
Yeah, he's got a Roman grandfather.
Well, Gnatus means born.
Oh, okay.
But I don't. I guess you don't necessarily divide the word that way. Mm. And it could be a Romanization of his name.
Yes, true, yeah.
They try to envelop, as Caesar says, the remaining legions and attack the camp. So while the legions are in the thick of it, the Nervii try to kind of come around the outside and close them in. The cavalry are now arriving at that camp with the baggage train. And basically we've got chaos because of all of this fighting going on. It doesn't go well at all. The chaos alarms the horsemen of the Treveri, whose reputation for valor amongst the Gauls is unique. So these Treveri, they're
fighting with Caesar. Belgae,
but exactly, they're yep. auxiliaries.
So they are alarmed.
Yes. And in chapter 24, when they saw our camp filled with the host of the enemy, our legions hard-pressed and almost surrounded in their grip, the sutlers, this is a great translation, this means camp followers, the kind of camp servants. The horsemen, the slingers, Numidians, sundered, scattered, and fleeing in all direction. In despair of our fortunes, they made haste for home and reported to their state that the Romans were repulsed and overcome, and that the enemy had taken possession of their camp and baggage train.
Oh, right. So they wrote off the Romans in this battle.
Yep. They basically say it's all over.
They should
know, stay to the end.
I thought their reputation for valor was unique amongst the Gauls.
Well, they give up easily, though, don't they? They're obviously, their character is not as fully formed as the Romans, is the implication. They might be brave, but again, there's this kind of build-up of the Gauls do everything on a moment-by-moment basis.
Yeah.
They're flippity-gibbets.
Flippity-gibbets.
As my mother would say. They change their minds very, very quickly.
Is your mother Mary Poppins?
There's kind of no consistency there. Yeah. They might be brave, as I say, in the moment.
Yeah.
But then they kind of despair too easily, I guess, in this circumstance. He doesn't explicitly say that, but that's the implication.
At this point, Caesar talks like he can see everything that's going on at once in the battle, doesn't he? So we get a really good overview of how desperate it is and how the tide's going to be turned.
Yeah, and again, we get the tension built up before Caesar comes in and puts it right, basically, or Caesar and the Romans.
Yeah.
And yeah, we get it from his point of view, and because he's the first word of the chapter again, and it's what he sees, what he recognises. He recognises the 12th Legion are packed in too close. He recognises that, to quote from chapter 25, all the centurions of the 4th cohort had been slain,
mm-hmm.
the standard bearer likewise, and the standard was lost.
Which is terrible.
Awful shame.
It's worth a movie in itself, getting that thing back.
There have been movies. Almost all the centurions of the other cohorts were either wounded or killed. Among them, the chief centurion, Publius Sextius Baculus, bravest of the brave, who was overcome by many grievous wounds so that he could no longer hold himself upright.
That's a good name check.
It is, and he's, you know, he's not a very, even though he's chief centurion, right, primipilus, he's risen to that rank, presumably. He doesn't come from an aristocratic background. So getting named in this kind of work is a big deal. And getting named as the very bravest man is, again, Caesar paying homage to the ordinary troops. He's doing something quite notable here, that to actually mention him and to give him this kind of aristocratic quality of being extremely brave, extremely strong.
Yes.
And it's tragic as well, of course, because he's dying.
Yeah.
And it's very, very cinematic. To quote again from this chapter, "Taking therefore a shield from a soldier of the rearmost ranks, as he himself was come thither without a shield, he went forward to the first line."
Wait, so we're third personing here, but this is actually Caesar.
It is.
"Takes a shield, rushes forward.
And calling on the centurions by name and cheering on the rank and file, he bade them advance and extend the companies that they might ply swords more easily." So he actually goes into the thick of it, grabs a shield from someone else, urges on the soldiers around him. So, you know, this is like something from Henry V. He's into the breach himself.
Yeah, yeah. But also he doesn't terribly have an option. He's caught in the middle of the battle. Mm. So might as well. Well done, Caesar.
He's not. There's no self-protection going on here, though, and he's very keen to tell us that, of course. You know, battle scenes are not always my favourite. There are other things about this work that I enjoy more, but this is really, really well put together, I think. So this chapter is, there's pathos, the tragedy with the death of Baculus, there's exciting action, what will happen next when they're in trouble. And the thing to note about it, if anyone's got access to the Latin, because the English does divide it up, is that nearly all of chapter 25 is just one sentence.
Oh, okay.
All right, that's the way it seems to work.
So Caesar was excited when he wrote it.
It makes it more exciting. It makes it more imminent. Mm. It's there. It's all happening on top of one another. Everything from Caesar, the first word of the chapter, to "they might ply swords more easily."
Yes.
And it pretty much all hangs on Caesar saw. This is what he saw, and this is what he saw he had to do.
What does Caesar do then? He's got the 12th Legion too close together fighting, so he's going to reorganize things a little bit.
Yeah, he gets one of the other legions, the 7th Legion, and reorganizes them so that they're more efficient, more effective. He draws the legions together to support the rear, and this support in itself gives the soldiers confidence. He doesn't go into detail about exactly how he does this. They're just kind of reorganized.
Sure.
The cavalry, who are around the baggage, see what's happening, and Titus Labienus.
He's been mentioned a number of times.
Yeah, he takes possession of the enemy's camp and sends the 10th Legion, the ones who got harangued at the beginning, to support. And Caesar was a priority, says Caesar. Priority for them.
But he would be, yeah.
Yeah. "They spared not a tittle of their speed."
I've got in brackets here, what is Latin for a tittle?
You know what? When you asked me that, I went and looked at my lerb, and I don't know when I did this, but when I read that the first time many years ago, I thought that was a misprint. I've actually got a pencil and underlined the T of tittle.
Oh, yeah.
Because obviously I thought it was little.
Yeah, but it's not.
It's not. The Latin isn't quite as exciting as the English translation, really.
Oh, okay.
"They spared nothing, nihil, okay. Nothing of their speed."
So I looked up tittle as well, and it's the dot over an I and the dot over a J.
Exactly.
Lowercase.
So a tiny little bit, I guess.
A tiny little bit, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, everyone should start using it in that way. See what happens.
Okay, so the arrival of the 10th rallies the troops.
Yeah, even the wounded get up and start fighting in chapter 26. "Even such of our troops that had fallen under the stress of wounds propped themselves against their shields and renewed the fight." But Caesar's very keen to tell us that the Nervii are extremely brave too. They're a worthy opponent. Both sides fight bravely. "So the Romans met their armed assault even without arms." Wow, that's... I had reread that bit and hadn't really noticed that they're taking on Nervii who've got weapons.
Barehanded.
Yes. It's pretty impressive. "Finally, the cavalry, to obliterate by valour the disgrace of their flight, fought to surpass the legionaries."
Mm.
Right. So very typical of what you often see in Caesar, that the troops are keen to impress him, especially if they've done something wrong beforehand. He inspires them, and they vie to restore honour in his eyes.
"And for their own part, the Nervii displayed a prodigious courage."
Yeah. they're not just easily beaten, which, of course, we've had a crisis here. But given at the beginning, you know, they were driven into the river and just mown down. Mm. I think it's in Caesar's interest to show us that they are a really tough enemy.
Yes.
And he does seem to display admiration for them, even. As he says, when their front ranks had fallen, the next stood on the prostrate forms and fought from them. So they're literally standing on the bodies of their companions and fighting. When these were cast down and the corpses were piled in heaps, the survivors, standing as it were upon a mound, hurled darts on our troops or caught and returned our pikes. Yeah, catching javelins.
Yeah. I caught a javelin, he have it back.
Yeah.
No. That's in the movies.
It would happen in the movies, wouldn't it? I'm starting to think that Caesar invented a lot of the tropes for battles in movies. But this picture of them standing on their own dead as the pile gets bigger and bigger.
Yes.
Not without reason, therefore, was it to be concluded that these were men of great courage. He uses the word virtus, which literally means manliness.
Mm.
It's a really important quality for the Romans. These men who had dared to cross a very broad river, to climb very high banks, and to press up over most unfavorable ground. He's really using the superlatives there.
Mm.
They did a lot of tough stuff.
Came in threes as well.
Yeah, except for another tricolon. These were tasks of the utmost difficulty, but greatness of courage had made them easy.
Ah.
So they're not just nobodies. This is a huge victory to have defeated them.
But they lost.
They did.
And he drops it on you.
They lost. Yeah, exactly. It's it's clearly a last stand if you're fighting on the bodies of your own companions, I suppose. Even the defeat is kind of full of superlatives because he says, this is a famous quote, this engagement brought the name and the nation of the Nervii almost to utter destruction. The word he uses is basically extinction, annihilation. Yeah. Which is clearly an exaggeration, as commentators are very keen to tell us. The Nervii are back in book 5, so they haven't been wiped out.
That was spoilers. I might edit that out.
Even at this point, what he really means is the fighting men have all been destroyed, because he says the older men and the women tend to surrender. Caesar is, as he pretty much consistently represents himself, the first time around against an enemy, he's merciful.
Mm.
Second time, not so much. Caesar was most careful for their preservation. He bade them keep their own territory and towns and commanded their neighbors to restrain themselves and their dependents from outrage and injury.
Okay, so they've had enough. Just leave them alone now, everyone.
Well, we shall see.
The Aduatuci, of whom I have written above, were coming with all forces to the assistance of the Nervii. But upon report of this battle, they left their march and returned home, and abandoning all their towns and forts, they gathered all their stuff in one stronghold, which was admirably fortified by nature. Capital N.
Well, in this translation, yes.
Is that some sort of local deity coming out? And
Natura was a Roman goddess.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to claim
anything's
that then.
Anything's a god.
Yes, sure thing. So these are people who have clearly learnt from the past mistakes of other local tribes.
Yeah, don't take on the Romans when they're winning. And we see this in a few places. So they know the local area. They can use the landscape to their advantage. I guess Caesar's set this up, as he often does, as this is a pretty tough prospect for the Romans to overcome.
Sure. Yeah.
Let me show you how we overcame it.
Yeah. And these are allies of the Nervii who were, as Caesar says, late to the fight. So they would have added to the numbers. And now that they've turned up late, have seen what awaits them, and scarpered, Caesar takes chase.
Yeah, and look, he's got more reasons for doing this because, as he tells us, the tribe was descended from the Cimbri and the Teutoni. This is another really important thing for Caesar to state, because if you remember back to book 1, it was so long ago, I don't know, but his audience would immediately remember that these were the peoples who had fought against Marius. They'd actually invaded Italy and they had to be driven out by Marius, who of course is Caesar's uncle by marriage, so it never harms for him to make that connection.
Yeah.
The Cimbri and Teutoni they've left these descendants, and they are the Aduatuci.
Yes, and so Caesar's building up why they are a credible threat and need to be dealt with, despite the fact that they're locking themselves away and praying to local deities to help with their stronghold.
Yeah, well, he mentions towards the end of this chapter that they haven't been welcomed by the local people that they settled in. they've had to fight them
Invaders are not welcome.
Yeah.
What a surprise.
This party, he says, this is of the people who were kind of left behind by the Kimbri and Teutoni, after the destruction of the others, were harassed for many years by their neighbours. Mm. So the outcome of this is they've got lots of experience fighting.
Okay.
So, you know, experience comes up a lot, and usually Caesar's using it about his own troops, but here it refers to the Aduatuki, and that means they're formidable enemies.
So the Romans stand around the stronghold, presumably from a safe distance where they can't be hit by a javelin or a pullum or a sling or whatever the Aduatuki might decide to hurl at them, and they are quite amused.
Yeah, and they're way up high, so it's like they're looking down on the Romans because it's a very high wall they've fortified with. And
now, just be forewarned, I am resisting the urge to quote Monty Python, so off you go. Read out 30.
I don't think you need to resist.
No, don't give me permission. Do not give me permission. Off you go.
In chapter 30,
yes.
One of my favourite chapters ever, the Aduatuki, he says, they first of all laughed at us from the wall, so they're laughing at the Romans, and loudly railed upon us for erecting so great an engine at so great a distance. By what handiwork, said they, by what strength could men, especially of so puny a stature...
Oh, wait. They are French, though. This is complete... No, I've got to do... I thought in your general direction. Your father was a hamster and your mother smelt of elderberries.
Well, in that case, the Romans really are the British, as we've always wanted to be.
So they're erecting a great engine at a great distance.
Yeah, it's too far away. What damage can it do? But
yes.
But most bitingly of all, you're just teeny little men. For as a rule, he says, he explains in parenthesis, our stature, short by comparison with their own huge physique, is despised by the Gauls. And how could we hope to set so heavy a tower on the wall? So they don't think we're going to be able to do anything with these engines.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting in that barb, which clearly has come up before, and really something that nettles Caesar, that the Gauls are very tall, they're burly, they're kind of typical northern barbarians in that they've got bodily strength, but do they have the wit to win the battle?
Yes.
Can they do the strategy? Can they build the siege engines? Can they use the technology? Can they get to a point where the size of your body isn't going to be important?
Yeah, but Caesar's building these siege works knowing full well what's coming next and probably laughing at them laughing. Otherwise, he wouldn't put this in here.
No. Exactly. This is not leading to an Asterix moment where the Gauls kind of managed to undermine the Romans. This is leading to a Caesar overcoming the deluded enemy moment.
So as soon as they see that the siege works can move, they send Legati to negotiate.
Yeah. Yeah. So these engines were being built a long way away. The point of saying that is, well, if they're all the way over there, they're not going to be able to throw things at our walls from there.
Yes.
But what they don't realise is they've got the good old things called wheels on them.
Yes.
I kind of doubt this account. The Gauls wouldn't realise you could put wheels on it. But hey, this is what Caesar tells us. And as it gets wheeled in, it starts to intimidate them.
Yeah, but as soon as they get into cow flinging distance, they're fine.
What did they do? They submitted themselves and all they had to the power of Rome. This is what the Romans want to hear. The reason they do this is that they think that the Romans are being helped by gods. The Romans must have divine aid to be able to do this wondrous thing of moving a siege engine closer.
They built wheels.
So it's Roman technology, Roman ingenuity against Gallic brute strength.
Yeah, it's like they Romans. Don't even have wine. What barbarians?
Well, most of it is just implied, but yes, I think at this point in the narrative, we as the Roman reader are meant to be kind of cheering, yes. It kind of reminds me of moments in epic poetry where they don't even have to engage in the fight.
Yes.
Where, you know, Achilles comes back into the fight and he just stands there and roars. And just the power of seeing him and hearing him scares the Trojans and they run away.
Mm.
It's that same thing that he's kind of very efficient. He doesn't even have to carry out the siege.
So the Aduatuki asked to keep their arms, which is something that the Nervii asked as well. It was granted to the Nervii, but in this case, it's not granted to the Aduatuki. Caesar says no.
No, but he says he'll tell their neighbours to leave them alone.
Yes.
Do you think this is likely to work?
It feels like a parent going and telling the classroom bullies, you know, leave my kids alone a bit.
Yeah, I think it's going to make it worse for the Aduatuki.
Yes, yeah. So they throw their weapons over the wall.
This is quite Monty Python, isn't it?
Yes.
So the heaps of weapons were well nigh level with the top of the wall and the height of the ramp. How many weapons did they have in there? Because we've been told it's a really high wall.
Yeah, but cows take up a lot of volume. But they are sneaky and they hide a third of their weapons.
Yeah, so these deceitful Gauls, another common trope.
Yeah.
So they threw open their gates and on that day enjoyed the benefit of peace. They get pax. But I think we've already had a bit of an instigation of a further act here because they've kept a third of their weapons.
Again, it's not much of an act.
Well, a short scene.
Mm.
So they attack Caesar's camp at night. That is dealt with very quickly in the narrative. You're right. They're defeated quickly and 4,000 of them are killed. Caesar sells all of the booty, everything in the town. That would include the people. The slave dealers gave him a receipt for 350,000 people.
That's a lot.
It's an awful lot of people.
How full was that stronghold?
Well, yeah. I mean, they had gathered them from all of their towns into this one fort. I imagine some people would have been glad it was over quite quickly because it couldn't have been comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says literally 350,000 capitum numerus, number of heads.
Mm. I assume there's bodies attached, but yeah, still a grim fate.
Yeah, it's a huge number.
Okay, so thus ends the Aduatuki. That was quick.
They really don't get a lot of attention, do they?
Yeah, somebody who gave Marius the runaround. Oh, you know, descended from people who gave Marius the runaround.
And I think it's one of those instances where it's Caesar telling us that he can deal with problems very quickly. It's not the narrative that he wants to build up as the great kind of epic narrative. He's already done that with the Belgae, largely the Nervii in this book.
Yes.
So this is kind of an add-on to show that he can deal with people kind of almost on several fronts.
Yeah.
Right? He's already had his big battle. Now there's a siege, and it's a siege that didn't really happen. Mm. So there's nothing very, if you can see it like this, heroic to talk about here.
Speaking of things that weren't very heroic and doesn't need much talking about, apparently, we get a meanwhile at the end of this book, which is Publius Crassus, who we have been introduced to in book one and garners a mention because he is the son of the, quotation fingers, Crassus, has, and this sounds very exciting to be chuffed away in one para, has been sent with one legion, the 7th, against the Veneti, the Venelli, the Osismi,
gets harder.
Yeah, okay, give me a second. The Curio Solite, the Esubi, the Olerci, and the Radones.
Mm-hmm.
That's close enough. But that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 tribes. The maritime states which border upon the ocean, so I mean.
So we're talking
over Britain way.
Yeah, Brittany, Normandy.
Yeah. Publius Crassus has been sent with one legion against all those tribes way over deep into Gaulish territory. And we're told that it has been reported that all these states have been brought into the subjection to the power of Rome. So, tick. And this is Armorica, I believe that region's called, which is Asterix country. So, there's my mention for the episode. So, what do you make of this?
So part of the reason it's had such a brief mention, it's basically chapter 34, is that he's going to go into more detail in book 3. This might look a bit strange because, as we've discussed before, Caesar chops up the Gallic War into a book a year.
Yes.
So this is the year 57.
Mm.
But at the end of book 2 and at the end of the year 57, Caesar does his usual, I'm going back to hang out in Italy for a bit.
Yes.
But it's over that winter that most of this fighting between Crassus and the Gallic peoples of the northwest goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those difficult, quite where to position it. He just wants to mention it here, really.
Yeah.
So back to structurally, I suppose, so that he can say right at the end, all Gaul is pacified.
Yes.
All right. So this stuff that technically is still going on, messing up his structure at the end of the year, gets put into the next book so that he can make that big statement. He says at the beginning of chapter 35, with all Gaul pacified, basically how he starts it, at least in the Latin. These achievements in our translation brought peace throughout Gaul. It's phrased in the Latin in this something we call the ablative absolute, which makes it very compact. All right, with all Gaul pacified, he can do that in three words in Latin. And it's meant to be this big kind of statement. And it also has the all Gaul phrase there, which is how he started the whole work at the beginning of book one. And I do wonder whether maybe that stuff about Crassus is there because he didn't know at the time that he was going to write book three. All right, if you run with me here. If you go with the theory that he's writing each book as he goes along,
and
rather than
back
writing
the dispatches, yeah,
then maybe he thinks this is job done. He doesn't necessarily know, if you go with that year by year writing, that this has another five books in it and then a sixth one written by someone else. Because he ends with how grateful the Romans are to him. It's a big statement at the end. And for those achievements, upon receipt of Caesar's dispatches, 15 days thanksgiving was decreed, an honor that previously had fallen to no man. This is something called a supplicatio, all right, which we get the word supplication from, but it means much more a kind of handing out of gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that you get to give you honor. It's not quite like a triumph, which is a really big deal, and obviously what Caesar will be aiming for and eventually will get. He leaves for Italy. Remember, he's meant to be doing this job where he sets up the law courts and tries cases.
Oh, what, his actual job?
Yeah, his actual job. He says he's going back to Italy, but he means Cisalpine Gaul.
Yep.
And he seems to have no further thoughts of Gaul at this point.
And for those achievements, upon receipt of Caesar's dispatches,
a 15-day thanksgiving was decreed. Thanks indeed. An honor that had previously fallen to no man. That's it for today. Off you go. And remember, a day spent giving thanks to Caesar is a day well spent. Ave, ave.